penetrating and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddhist truth one with myself.
To the Buddha, to the Dharma, to the Sangha. In the 19th century, there was a writer named Matthew Arnold who in the midst of what he saw as the unnecessary and unreasonable attitudes of Victorian England and the search for something in religion that could act as an antidote to these attitudes, developed an idea of Christianity that was based on what he called the sweet reasonableness of Jesus. And when he talked about the sweet reasonableness of Jesus, I'm sure that he was thinking of some of the magnificent passages in the Gospels, such as the Sermon on the Mount, in which Jesus gave teachings that it now appears from study of the Dead Sea Scrolls and other sources that he himself was given in some of the more esoteric teachings of Judaism. I don't think that Matthew Arnold was thinking about some of the other descriptions of the actions of Jesus, such as when he drove the money changers out of the temple, apparently in a passion of outrage that such practices would be going on in the most sacred place, the very heart of the religion. The basic idea of sweet reasonableness, while Matthew Arnold gave a very eloquent voice to the idea in Victorian England, and indeed Tolstoy came out with a very similar idea in contemporary Russia. If you tried to apply it to the master-disciple relationship, it simply doesn't fit. It is not the job of a master to fulfill the ideals and expectations, to try to live up to the ideals and expectations of a disciple. To the contrary, in one way or another, whatever ideals the disciple is harboring, and often they're, at least initially, very unconsciously held ideals about how people should behave and what a spiritually advanced person should or should not do. You can bet that in relationship to a human master, these ideals are going to get a powerful working over and come up against some blunt realities. In the article by Durkheim, The Call for the Master, that I've been using along with the Master to use wonderful article entitled The Meaning of Discipleship. Durkheim says some things about masters which make this point really clear. If you're looking for sweet reasonableness, don't knock at this door. In one place he says, for the disciple, listening to a master means handing himself over to everlasting uproar. He can only do this in the long run if he starts to hear primal silence in this tumult, right within the tumult, and also to sense it in the master behind all his sudden changes of direction. Now, I think that some people would say, well, he's talking about Oriental masters. This doesn't apply to Western masters. But, you know, nowhere in this does he say anything, nor does our master, about this applying only to Oriental masters. In Zen's Eternal Life, our master says some things in one of the chapters that could be thought, you could be misconstrued as indicating that Western masters could live up to Western students' expectations better than Eastern masters do to their students, their disciples. But that's a misreading of what she's saying. The sudden changes of direction that Durkheim talks about would sometimes appear anything but sweet and anything but reasonable, have to do with the master's own efforts within his or her own spiritual life to follow the eternal. And the eternal does not go by our expectations, by our timeline, by our personal wishes. So changes of direction are not infrequent, and they can be radical changes of direction. Many times, training with River Master, we'd be headed down, the whole community would be headed down a certain direction in a certain area of our community life, and one day River Master would say, well, that's not working very well. We'll do something else. Boom. Off you go in another direction. And if you're sitting there thinking, oh, but you said, oh, but what about, you know, you get left in the dust. This is wonderful training for oneself, really learning to listen to, really learning to ask the eternal, not take things for granted. In each situation, learn to meditate with it and look for what is the way to follow the will of the eternal. What is the way of the true spirit of the precepts? What is the way to follow my heart? He goes on to say, the master's entrance, meaning here the master's entrance into the life of a disciple, is like the lion's roar. It heralds a life and death struggle. The struggle that no one destined for a higher level is spared, that no one called to the way can escape. It is a struggle that holds the ultimate promise but demands the ultimate effort. Dying and becoming in the fullest sense, and not once but as a way's everlasting rule and principle. Cut all ties, give up everything, is another way of putting this. He goes on to say, the Master is not a conventionally perfect human being. He does not embody the traditional values and virtues of beauty, truth, and goodness in any obvious sense. He says and does things that horrify the normal, decent citizen, and repeatedly aims his sharpest arrows at precisely that normal, decent citizen. He does not shore things up, but turns them upside down. No one can say what he will do next. He is as unpredictable and contradictory as life itself. I have to say that, at least in our way of practicing, if the Master horrifies and upsets the normal, decent citizen, I doubt very much that it's because they're trying to do so. But if you think of the normal, decent citizen as an ideal within the disciple, and this is really the point, the disciple holding on to an ideal of normalcy and decency and goodness and honor and virtue, then it is the Master's job, and it will happen naturally. Master don't have to try to do it. It will happen naturally that the Master will continually crash into that ideal. That ideal will continually crash into the Master. And what is it that's happening here? As Urban Master used to say, the Master is not the eternal, and the Master represents the eternal. So when the disciple looks at the Master, the disciple is seeing his or her own Buddha nature as in a mirror and being asked to look beyond the external appearances in another person to see that which lies beyond good and evil in the worldly sense, beyond right and wrong in the worldly sense. The Master represents the disciple's own heart, own true nature. So the Master's humanity necessarily, it follows from this, the Master's humanity necessarily mirrors to the disciple the disciple's own humanity. And what the disciple doubts, dislikes, fears, dreads, hates, suspects, judges within himself or herself, the disciple will see in the Master, mirrored in some way or other. And it is not the Master who is deliberately doing this, and it is not the disciple who is deliberately doing this. It is the Eternal that is causing this to happen. It's able to happen because the disciple said sincerely, I wish to find my own Buddha nature. And I enter into this relationship with the Master as an adult human being, a responsible adult, in order to help this happen. So the Eternal says, right, I've been waiting for this, so let's get down to it. And sweet reasonableness isn't in it. It's not in the picture. A Master who just fulfills our expectations of what a person should be like won't really help us. Now, as a matter of fact, as the disciple trains himself or herself, as conversion happens within the disciple sees more and more where the master is coming from and is more and more on board with what is going on. Except when the master himself or herself makes a mistake in Buddhism. Then the disciple's job is to learn from it and not to copy the mistake. But a disciple has to get far enough along that he or she can really tell when there is something to copy, when there is not. And this is one of these seemingly direct contradictions, which is not a contradiction, but it seems like it. And right from the beginning, it is the disciple's responsibility to follow his or her heart. And the disciple gets the consequences of his or her actions. No one in this business ever cedes responsibility for his or her own actions to anyone else. The only way to live with these seeming contradictions with an actual relationship of master and disciple is to keep meditating. And to oneself, whether one is in position of master or of disciple, to oneself undergo that life and death struggle that he's talking about here. Of the conversion of karma. Reasonableness is the opposite of passion. And these are opposites. The true middle path transcends the opposites. Sometimes, in following the eternal, our actions will appear to be guided by reason, or to be reasonable. Sometimes they will appear to be guided by passion, or to be passionate. And if there is a true following of the eternal, a true living from the heart, one is actually transcending these opposites. And the appearances are misleading. The eternal can use both reasonableness and reason and passion. And the eternal can use the appearance of reasonableness and passion. And the eternal is not to be found by clinging to either of these opposites or by swinging between them. Therefore, I'll again, this line from Durkheim that really tells what the disciple has to do. He says the disciple can only do this, this true listening to the master. And the true listening to the master, above everything else, means a true listening to one's own inner master, the Buddha nature. He can only do this in the long run if he starts to hear primal silence within the tumult, within the reasonableness. He goes beyond the appearance and finds something deeper. Within the passion, he goes beyond the appearance and finds something deeper. And also to sense it in the master. Behind all his sudden changes of direction. On this